Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Hi, it's Stephen Colbert, and I'm here to tell you about The Late Show Pod Show, which is the podcast of The Late Show with me, Stephen Colbert, and I'm here with my producer of the podcast, Becca. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Stephen.
So what do people get when they listen to The Late Show Pod Show? Let's sell this thing.
The extended moments, for sure, because we run out of time for broadcast, but we have plenty of time on the podcast.
It's kind of like being a live audience member of the show because you get things that no one else hears. Listen to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to hell is what I'd be saying if I was Lilith from Diablo 4.
You'd be saying it 33 episodes sooner.
Exactly. We should have talked about Diablo on 666. We ruined everything. Actually, I blame Blizzard. They should have released it far earlier.
Lazy devs couldn't hit our deadlines.
We'll be talking about some Diablo this week because young Matthew Perslow has been playing a bit of it, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a good job you're checking now, isn't it?
Yeah. Before it would be embarrassing if you hadn't, wouldn't it?
Oh my God, has he not played it?
Matt Jones is here.
Hi.
As well. And he's going to talk about some Spider-Verse. Ooh. And so am I, because I've also seen Spider-Verse. And right at the end of this show, after feedback, we're going to do some Succession spoiler chat, because I just need to talk about Succession with some people. And, you know, we'll do that right at the end. You'll get fair warning if you, for some reason, haven't watched Succession. So
go away, watch all four seasons of it, and then come back to this episode.
Exactly.
Just speed through it.
Should we get into it? I don't know. I just had a handful of chili heat wave Doritos actually to get me in the zone for this.
11:53 in the morning.
Well, it's because I normally have lunch at like 12:30, but we're going to be halfway through recording. I'm like, my stomach's going to be going if I don't have something before we record. And I was like, do you know what? They were open. I thought I'm just going to have like 6 Doritos. That'll keep me going.
I actually have a Doritos chili heat wave story. I promise we, listeners, we didn't plan this.
No.
After the live podcast that we recorded, if you were there, congratulations. It was an incredible night, really a lot of fun. But after it, I leave and I go to a corner shop and I buy some chili heat wave Doritos and I'm outside eating it. I'm like, these are like really stale. This is weird. And so I scan the packet and they've taped up the bottom. Like, it's clearly opened up. And whoever ran the shop was like, no, you can still sell these. So I'm like, I finished them, obviously, because, you know, still chili heat wave Doritos, even if they're a little bit stale and gross. But I have to, like, contend with the idea that these have probably been on the floor, right?
Mm, who knows what's happened to those? Well, I'm glad you're still here today to tell the story, because that could have gone
I'm a stronger
horribly
person for it.
Wrong.
It didn't kill me.
Exactly. What's your Dorito story, Matt?
I think they're all right. Quite like cool original.
Oh, because you are a cool original man, aren't you? That's why. let's talk about some games, because Chili Heatwave, that's got to be Lilith's favourite flavour, hasn't it, in Diablo? I keep talking about Lilith. Who is Lilith, Matt?
Lilith is the, I believe they call her the Mother of Hatred. She is technically the demon that I believe is that gave birth to Sanctuary, the world that Diablo is set in, which was designed, as the name suggests, as kind of like a sanctuary between the war of hell and heaven. But yeah, she's the main antagonist of Diablo 4.
Nice.
Big
is the
demon
good?
Lady. Yeah, seems it. So what I will
good,
say...
let's move on.
is as a complete disclaimer before we get into this, as you might know if you've read a couple of other reviews from other outlets, particularly the Eurogamer review that didn't exist as of I was reading yesterday, we didn't really get given a huge amount of time to play this game. Mm-hmm. We were essentially given a week, and then all of our characters were burnt in hell. And now we had to wait until today for them to come back. We won't be able to play those characters again, so we've got to start from the beginning.
Why do you think that is, by the way? It's because it's a balance thing? Or?
It's an MMO now, so right. Therefore they've obviously kind of like burnt the ground back to ground zero so that everybody starts at the same time, right? And I guess kind of like when you are building an MMO, when the servers get turned on for public, like it's from the start. So I don't have any of the characters that I was playing. And also, we were given access to Diablo right as fucking Tears of the Kingdom landed, which, as you can imagine for IGN, was quite a big deal and meant that we were all working on Tears of the Kingdom stuff. So I have only really played as much as what some of you might have played in the beta. So okay. I've played all the way through to the end of Act 1 and a touch into Act 2. So if you played the beta, what I'm going to talk about is going to be very familiar. And hopefully the people out there that didn't play the beta, so these words will actually mean something like important and informative to you.
I played most of that beta, so mm-hmm. I'm kind of where you are then.
Yeah. So do you think the game is good? I do think it's a lot like Diablo 3.
Okay.
Which means that it kind of does feel like you are playing a very similar game. There's definitely tweaks. Like, I think the character building is much better in this one than it was in Diablo 3. There is a gargantuan skill tree for each of the classes, which has got, like, A, looks really nice, because each time you select a skill, it fills, like, this weird pentagram-style arrangement with more blood, and the more the blood trickles down, it gets into different layers that you get to unlock new skills.
We like blood here. More blood.
I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
I love when menus are a little bit extra.
They've got a little bit of theming to it, so I like that. And definitely compared to kind of like Diablo 3, it feels like there's way more kind of option in terms of the way that you tweak your skills and tweak your spells or abilities, whatever you've got. So I think you can really make a character reasonably your own. I do feel, certainly at this point, I think the cooldowns are a bit long. Like, okay. Particularly,
Which class did you play as?
So I have now played as Necromancer and Sorcerer, cool. Of which I like them both equally. Necromancer in the beta, very overpowered. They've stripped it back a little bit. But with a necromancer, you can summon a little army of the dead. And as you level up, that army gets bigger and more deadly.
That was always what I played in Diablo 2. Mm-hmm. And then, like, I would get maybe 60 hours in and I would realize that I'm, like, not doing anything.
Because the skeletons can just go and do everything for you.
So I have to, like, talk myself out of playing, like, necromancer classes mm-hmm. now, even though it's my preferred one. Because I'm like, I actually want to play it.
Yeah,
like you were saying, Matt, like it's not in terms of gameplay, by no means a radical departure from 3 or Diablo. Like, if you have played a Diablo, you'll know what you're getting into here. If you haven't, you're essentially walking around these maps, if you're just holding in a button and waiting for cooldowns to come back. I've made it sound very simple there. Like, it is not the most complicated game, but it is highly satisfying. That's the thing about Diablo. Yeah. That loop is so satisfying.
That's the thing, yeah. I think kind of like, from my experience, it's just like not hitting, particularly with the way that its cooldowns work. I found it very difficult to get into a very cool rhythm where I'm like, okay, I know I do this, 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 and that creates a massive kind of bang and everyone dies. It does feel like I'm doing this, and then I might be doing a bit of this. Then I might be doing a bit of this. So I'm finding it a bit difficult to find the rhythm, particularly because some abilities like have like a 30-second cooldown, like 35 seconds, and that's a long time to wait.
Yeah.
Particularly for a game that is as fast-paced as Diablo. So I think there's still probably some work to do, even now we're at launch with that. I also, the dodge has got like, I think it's 4 or 5 second cooldown on it, which, when there's an element of, I know it's not the same sort of game, but like the action RPG elements and the top-down perspective does bring a little bit of Hades into it, right? And because you're dodging so much in Hades, I do think, like, while I understand that the way that Diablo's combat works means that cooldowns are an integral part of it, I would like to see that cooldown be more like 2 seconds, because it feels a long time between dodges.
Do you think that'll be like a skill tree thing, perhaps? Like, if you get far enough?
I don't think so, because the dodge is universal. Like, every character has that dodge, and it doesn't have any, like, bearing on its skill. Maybe there's something in perhaps the rogue skill tree that could do something about that, because it feels like more in keeping with their abilities. But certainly both the sorcerer and the necromancer in the hours that I've played of it hasn't had the ability to do anything about that.
I will say, like, from the beta, I had a very fun time with the beta, and like you're saying, I felt, oh, this is more Diablo. I feel at home here. It's at home in one of the most horrible places I've ever played in. But the one thing that did surprise me is, and you're actually not too much further, so my question is kind of invalid. I was just wondering about story, because it did actually grab me story-wise in the beta. I was like, oh, I'm surprised. There's like an early like bait and switch that's quite cool. And like, I was actually engaged, so it was in Diablo 3, which I played quite a bit of. I couldn't tell you what happened. I was just walking through and smashing everything.
Yeah, like the stories have always been relatively simple, but if any of you managed to catch the article I wrote last week about Diablo, I think it's got a bit of StarCraft in its storytelling, and I really like StarCraft 2's campaign story.
Do the Protoss show up?
No, not quite. But what I mean by that is, so there's obviously there's a higher dedication to the narrative side in this one. And so there are effectively, I guess, three different variations of storytelling in the way that it shows that story. So you've got your standard bits of lore drops and conversation, which take place from the standard kind of top-down view. But it has this really nice ability to kind of zoom the camera in and maybe lower it by a couple of inches, like on a pan. And so you do get points where, like, when you're chatting to people, the camera will gently drop down into the world a little bit and show you from a slightly more cinematic angle, I guess. But when things like really start to get very narrative heavy, it does these beautiful transitions. Like, there's a bit where you go into a church, and if you've played the beta, you'll know this one. And there's some petals on the floor. Well, that's kind of like the petals are part of wherever Lilith goes, she leaves like these petals, which presumably are made of blood. And then the petals kind of like drift up to the screen, and they use it as a transition to bring the camera right down into the world. And now you're in a cutscene, like these really beautifully animated cutscenes that have got, like, because they're so dark and gothic, and the way that the characters move, they remind me a bit of stop motion animation. They've got that like freakiness that's inherent to that animation style. And that really allows you to get close up to the characters' faces and see how detailed this game engine is, which reminds me a lot of how in StarCraft 2, when you'd go back to the like your main base, rather than it being an isometric RTS style, you were up close with the characters, and it allowed you to have a lot better kind of like interaction with those people. You got to know them because you're seeing them face to face rather than just through voice lines. And then obviously when the action properly kicks into fucking gear in this, you get a Blizzard CGI cutscene, like how the game opens, which everybody's seen, I think, because that was revealed at BlizzCon, I think, where, you know, you've got these three people that are being sacrificed to bring Lilith back from wherever she was.
Yeah, a lot of blood in this game.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is kind of like compared to Diablo 3, which obviously had a slightly more kind of horror comic book kind of vibe, this is full kind of like relatively realistic looking graphics, very heavy goth, lots of shadows, an awful lot of blood.
Is it in the running for the wettest game of the year?
Might be there.
The opening, certainly the first cutscene where basically they create a triangle of viscera and have Lilith kind of come through it, that's very wet. There's not as much blood in the combat, but it's definitely, whereas Diablo 3 is a dark fantasy, this is properly horror. Like, people get their jaws smashed in. And
it could be, might be the wettest game until maybe Foam Stars comes out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because that's, what a damp game that looks.
We've got the Square Enix showcase coming up soon. Maybe we'll know a little bit more about Foam Stars.
Who knows? I haven't really, because it's literally just launched this game, so I don't know. Obviously, the thing that's played the last couple of Diablo games, 3 and Immortal, have been microtransaction issues, have been store issues.
Yeah.
I don't know if those have come to light yet, if it's anywhere near as bad as it has been.
So certainly, so I went on this morning, because obviously the shop didn't open until today.
Yeah.
And it reminds me a lot of Assassin's Creed Valhalla's shop.
Okay.
And in terms of it's an awful lot. It just seems to be cosmetics purely. So you go into the shop thing, and like a lady kind of summons up a load of collectible cards basically and arranges them in a deck in front of you. And it's got that Fortnite-esque in that, like, there's a few days left on this shop and then they're going to rotate over later. But it was basically a lot of kind of like cosmetic designs for each of your characters. So the way the cosmetics work in this, in the game, there's a transmogrification system. So in each town, there's a wardrobe that you can go to. And when you go to the wardrobe, basically any item you find, and I think it's the majority of items that you find, because obviously it's a loot game. You know, every time you kill something, you pretty much get some loot. If you salvage it at the blacksmith, it takes the image of that and puts it in your wardrobe. So even if you've got armor that you really don't like the look of, you can go into that wardrobe and make it look like armor that you've had before. So you get to coordinate and dye it and all of that. And basically in the shop, you can pay money, probably more money than any people really want to spend, because that's microtransactions. But if you really want to, you can spend money on very cool looking gothic kind of outfits, and that will throw them in the wardrobe for you, and you can put them on your character.
But this time around, you're not selling them to other players.
No, it's not. It's not that fucking auction house that 3 launched with, which, like, I understand kind of like the... I can see why there were a bunch of people at Blizzard that were like, oh, people love the auction house in World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
That's like a big part of its economy. We'll do that for Diablo. It's like the way that they implemented it, absolute flaming disaster. It seems like we're free of that.
Yeah, that transmog thing reminds me, because I'm currently replaying Cyberpunk. And let me tell you, I'm having an incredible time. Now my expectations are set firmly at an 8 out of 10 kind of Deus Ex crossed with Fallout game. I'm having a fantastic time of it. And they have... all the updates have happened since I first played it. So now there is the transmog system with the wardrobe, and I'm just like creating incredible outfits. I'm looking amazing. I just romance Judy. I'm having a lovely time.
it did really feel like when you were playing Cyberpunk, it was just wearing short shorts and a bike helmet, right? Like you didn't feel very Cyberpunk the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. You're always wearing the ugliest shit. It's a bit like I'm about halfway through a replay of Cyberpunk that I'm doing very casually. And I got the Edge Runner's jacket, but it's like... It suddenly disappears the moment you get it, right? Because it's got too much loot, really. It's got as much loot as a looter game, really.
Cyberpunk's great. But so is Diablo. So is Diablo.
Yeah, no, I am enjoying it. I'm looking forward to starting a brand new character again.
The annoying thing is I'm off away now for 2 weeks, and I won't be able to play until I get back. Yeah. And the thing is, I'd want to play this game co-op, and I know by the time I get back, everyone's going to be miles ahead of me, and I'm just going to be like, I'm not playing a lot of this.
Right. The Monster Hunter problem.
Thing that it does have is that kind of like, I think it's definitely built for co-op. Like, I'm not entirely sure if the combat loop is as strong, particularly in 2023, when it feels like maybe there's not been a huge advancement in its combat loop, but I think it works really well as a co-op game, and I've played it co-op for a few hours. But it does have the pull of, it's obviously gone open world now, so there's no kind of like, each area flows into each other really nicely. So there is an element of exploration to it now, and those areas are really nice. And some of the dungeon designs have been quite good. I'm really pleased with, even though a lot of the dungeons obviously are randomly generated, as is the kind of Diablo style, it still does that thing where it's got rooms that are bespoke for those dungeons, and those rooms will be in roughly the same place, but the route between those rooms is different, and the thematic sort of development of all of these dungeons does still feel really good, and crunching your way through it and, as I say, raising an army of skeletons or demolishing things with electric bolts and all the kind of good stuff that sorcerers do, it looks pretty, it looks vibrant while you're doing it, and it's got that gothic element that when you light it up with an electric beam or something like that, it creates this really unearthly, horrible kind of vibe to it all.
Yeah, I'm kind of... I've just got to find time to play it, because I'm still playing Tears of the Kingdom. I'm now 70 hours into Zelda, and I was right at the end, and then it kind of opened up a whole new pathway for me.
You've played, like, that's 20 hours more than I have.
Yeah, I've been playing a lot of that game.
No, I dare not check how long I've played.
I think I'm at 70. It was over 65 the other nights, and I've definitely played a few hours in between that.
What I will say is that, like, Diablo's not a long game by any chance. Like, I know someone that got as far as Act 4 in the like review period that we had, you know, that kind of week. And they were only mainlining it because they were doing core story. So there's obviously quite a lot of side quests out there. And obviously plenty of optional dungeons to dive into, but I think kind of you can mainline it probably in about 30 hours.
Yeah, and it's all about the end game as well, Diablo, isn't it? And I don't. Maybe we'll check back in if any.
One of the things that you can do, not that this helps you to begin with, Cardi, but once you finish the game once, you can upgrade any other character you make so that they essentially skip the campaign and go directly into end game.
Cool. That's a really good system.
Nice. Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting stuck in, getting all bloody, killing some demons. Have you got a favorite demon?
I mean,
write in IGN underscore UK feedback IGN.com favorite demons. Yeah. First ones that pop into mind, Paimon from Hereditary.
He's pretty
good,
cool
little demon. Yeah. And obviously you got your classics like Pazuzu.
Pazuzu's
still accidentally summoning them by mentioning him in this audio recording.
When does a demon become a demon? I mean, that's the question. Do you know what one freaks me out? Have you seen Insidious? Like the red demon from Insidious.
Ooh,
he's
weird.
Freaky. Yeah, I don't like him.
Yeah.
There we go.
Is the Babadook a demon?
Is he real? That's the question. That's the.
We all have our own demons, right? So that means that he gets to be one of those.
Yeah. Heroin.
Is that what the Babadook was about?
Let's carry on. Let's talk about Across the Spider-Verse, which has a heroine in Gwen Stacy. Oh, that was a what a segue.
We have
that
to keep
was.
That in now.
Oh, it was never going away. Don't worry. I saw this last night. Matt, you saw this a couple of days ago.
Matt Jones,
that is. Why is there two Matts? Very annoying. We need a new name for someone.
I never told this story before, did I? That I entered... Oh, I'm going to regret this immediately afterwards. I started in an office that already had two Matts once, so I had to be MJ for the entire rest of my career there. Which,
well, that's also
very much Spider-Verse. Yeah.
Exactly. Maybe we'll go with that. Because, we have one or two Matts in the US as well. God, so many Matts. Spider-Verse, Across the Spider-Verse, the sequel to Into the Spider-Verse. And the first part of a double bill that was going to be Across the Spider-Verse Part 1 and Part 2, but is now, third one's called, is it Beyond the Spider-Verse?
I think that is the case, yes.
Yeah.
And I do think that you should know that it's the first part going in.
Absolutely.
I think that you will benefit a lot for like knowing that there will be a little bit of a cliffhanger at the end.
So I was, when I saw that last night, I was aware of that, and the person I was seeing it with did not know that, and they're like, this film's been going, 'cause it's like 2.25 hours, it's quite long for an animated film, and it keeps ramping.
It's it's the 10th longest animated film.
There we go.
It's the longest one from an American studio. I told somebody that fact at the premiere, and they were like, all right.
Someone read the doc.
Yeah.
But yeah, the person I was watching didn't know it was a first part. And they were like, it's been going along a while, and it doesn't seem like it's ending. And it just, that is the one, like, I should say this now, I absolutely loved this film to bits, but that, if there is one slight thing you can say on a bit, it just does end, and you're just like, well, I don't know how long we're waiting for the next part, but it does just kind of end. But I'm not going into it, that didn't bother me too much,
and I don't want to give it the impression that it doesn't resolve. Like, I do think that
there is
a resolution for like some of the characters. There just is a very, very prominent cliffhanger at the end of it, so just be aware of that.
Like, it's very much like an Empire. It is like an Empire Strikes Back or an Infinity War. I just don't feel like... I feel like what those films do so well is they do kind of end on... Well, Infinity War is definitely a cliffhanger. Empire Strikes Back, kind of a cliffhanger. Kind of like, you know, reaching the lowest point. And it's... Those films do a great job in the last, like, 5 or 10 minutes of kind of slowing things down again and, like, resetting and being like, here's the state of everything. Whereas this film is very much like, it feels like you're still going 100 miles an hour right until the last 3 seconds. And it's just like, dun! And then, to be continued, literally appears on screen. You're like, oh,
it
okay.
It's like hardly a criticism, though, to say that, like, I was enjoying the movie so much that I wish it continued, which
exactly.
It will. So.
It didn't feel like 2.25 hours. And my instant reaction is, I'm still, what, I saw this less than 24 hours ago. I was in the moment enjoying it more than I enjoyed the first one. Like,
wow, strong.
The first one's a tighter film because maybe they weren't ever expecting it to be this big a success and to do multiple ones of them. But just the sheer, like, I'm all for, this is very much the God of War Ragnarok to God of War. And I realize some people, probably most people prefer God of War 2018 to Ragnarok. I prefer Ragnarok because it just kind of goes for it and chucks everything at it. And this is what this does. I have, like, when I saw the first Spider-Verse, I was like, I've never seen animation like this. after this film, I was like, I have never seen animation like this. Like, it just takes it up a notch. Some of the stuff they're doing is just... the way they managed to make it feel like it's throwing everything towards your eyeballs, but at the same time, I'm never losing track of the action.
It's not
unbelievable,
despite so much going on. Yeah, absolutely.
It's absurd.
The trailers have shown scenes of the like Spider-Man chase where there's like a million things going on in the background. And in a lot of movies, that would be really overwhelming. And yet somehow you're scanning around looking for cool stuff, but you're still like necessarily paying attention to the stuff that's going on in the foreground, which it's really surprising.
And
technically
they still have time for those like more tender moments, like the softer moments. Like Spider-Verse has, you know, when Miles is talking to his dad, well, he can't talk to his dad through the door because he's got his mouth taped up. There's like, it's got a couple of those scenes, and they still just do a great job of the family side of it, especially
like, genuinely
the Gwen
really touched
side.
Me in some like areas of this movie. Like some of that stuff, like the movie is kind of about like parents trying to do the right thing, but not necessarily knowing what that is, or like trying to mentor in a way that's like some people are good at it and some people aren't. And it's really about like the lessons that people are trying to teach each other. Yeah. And that kind of is in the first film, but this really doubles down on it.
Yeah.
And normally I would be like, these soft moments are kind of taking away from the action, which is what you want to see. But I found those were kind of my favorite parts.
Yeah, I loved all of it. Like, and it is another like parallel. I do see a lot of God of War Ragnarok in this because it shares those similar themes of like parenthood and kids trying to like do it all themselves and try and be a bit rebellious. And like, this is as much a Gwen story as a Miles story. Miles is still the lead, but like Gwen is like the like 1B lead this time, I'd say. And her stuff's great. I just loved like... I'm not going to spoil any of them, but the amount of just amazing little cameos and funny jokes that are in this film, like, are so good. Like, people popping up all over the place, and you're just... And it just, for some reason, it never... Whereas, like, sometimes the MCU now, they, like, throw, like, I don't know, Howard the Duck or someone your way, and it's almost like a semi-art, where it's like, okay, yeah, we've seen it. In this, it never once felt gratuitous. It all just felt like, yeah, this belongs here.
Yeah, like, yeah. Everybody that's cool, everybody that's silly kind of gets a moment where they're, like, actually taken seriously, despite how, like, wild it is for them to appear in it.
I would watch it again now. Like, I'm sure there's stuff I missed as well, like, because there's so much going on. Like, and I would encourage, like, people... like see this in a cinema as well, because it looks
the
just
biggest
and sounds
screen
so,
that you can
the
I think.
Biggest screen possible. Are you excited for it, Matt?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I think the first one is probably the best Marvel movie we've ever had.
Yeah, it's
I liked Guardians 3 a lot. I know you two didn't
I still
really
like
get
Infinity
on with
War,
it,
but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm actually going to wait a little bit to see. When does it come out?
Today.
Yes, is it today?
Recorded.
Yeah. I won't watch it for a little while because I'll be going with my partner and she can't see it anytime soon. But yes, I am very much looking forward to it. I'm sure it will get half spoiled for me before, but I kind of don't see a spoiler actually ruining this film for me.
No, I don't think so. I think you could flat out know what's going to happen, and yet still
much of it is to do with that animation style and seeing it unfold in front of you, right? So I'm not worried about actually rushing out to see it, but I am looking forward to savoring all 2.25 hours of it.
Yeah. Oh, and shout out to Miles Morales, who in his high school bedroom this time has a Son Heung-min poster, the Spurs player. That made me smile extra wide.
Funny.
And no, that's why it's the best film of all time.
I can't believe Miles Morales is a Spurs fan.
I couldn't tell if it was him or Yankee, but either way.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah,
I'm into it either way. But yeah, just an amazing film.
Yeah. I think I haven't really seen anybody talk about this, but it also seems to like be deliberately reckoning with the presence of police in the first movie. Like it's a real thread of at least two characters that want to question what they're doing in their role as police. That seems like it is a question that was raised like during the production of the previous movie, where like we kind of shifted how we think about the relationship. And now, like, the movie is almost thinking about that a lot. So I would really love to talk about that in greater detail, but maybe we don't have the space for this today.
maybe not right now, but I just want to shout out the spot.
Oh, he's great. Jason Schwartzman
is so... he's actually a bigger part of the story than I thought. Not spoiling anything. Like, I thought he was just going to be like a fun little opening scene character. And he is. He's very fun. But at the same time, like, has as much as a man filled with spots can, has a lot of depth.
He has my favourite line in the movie, which I'll do now because I don't think it's very much of a spoiler. But he says, I've got a hole in me and I need to fill it with more holes. Which is a joke that works on a literal and subtext level.
Yeah. And also shout out to Daniel Kaluuya as Spider-Punk.
He's very so good. Cool. He steals the movie, honestly. He's really, really good in it.
What a film. I love it. Go watch Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. I can't stress that enough, really. I'm sure a lot of you were going to. Anyway, Matt, you haven't had time to see films because you're too busy playing games. You just love playing those games, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
And you've finished another one of those games, haven't you?
I haven't finished it. No.
You haven't finished it? Oh, no, you never finished games these days, do you?
I'm trying to finish Zelda. Like, that's the primary one, but this is my secondary game that I'm playing for at the moment.
This game's like almost, what, 30 years old? Yeah, well, is it over?
Well, originally 30 years old.
Yeah.
This is the remake of System Shock. System Shock being a 1994 PC game from Origin Systems.
Wow. And did you play it at the time?
I didn't, no. So this is actually the first time that I am playing System Shock.
You call yourself an immersive sim.
I know it academically, but if anybody has tried to play System Shock, they will know that, you know, if you didn't play it at the time, it's practically impossible to play right now. I mean, the people that have made this remake, which is a company called Night Dive Studios, they did a few years ago a remaster of, well, they called it the Enhanced Edition of System Shock, which added what many of us think is a very important little detail to a PC game, which is the ability to look around with a mouse. Because previous to a couple of years ago, you couldn't even do that. The original version.
This is a classic.
It is a classic. The original version, you can barely see what's in the environment because the HUD is so fucking massive. You have to look around with the arrow keys and walk with WASD, pretty much.
It's like a menu covering the whole screen.
Yeah.
Like, right?
Yeah. It's horrible to play. This is a complete remake that basically, when you look at it, it looks like you're looking at a modern game. You know, it has the standard HUD arrangement that we expect these days. It has a gun in the bottom right corner. It's got enemies in the world. You move around it like normal with either a mouse and keyboard or a controller. It's currently only out on PC, but I believe it's coming to consoles at a later undetermined point. So it controls like a normal game. And because it controls like a normal game and looks like it, I wouldn't say it's like a 2023 looking game, but it looks very nice. It's got modern 3D graphics with a, what I'd say, throwback kind of visual design. Everything's got a slight pixelated edge to it, so it's paying homage with the visuals to the 90s, but it still looks like a modern game. And because it looks and now plays more like a modern game, what you start to realize is that basically everything that's really good about its spiritual successor, BioShock, was already there in 1994, and that's been the biggest joy of playing this. Is I get a new BioShock game that is much more like BioShock than I ever originally thought System Shock was. I knew there was a lot of the things that were created that lineage, and obviously as the grandfather of the, well, not the grandfather of the immersive sim, but let's say the first game that really felt like it coalesced as this style of game. It has way more of what I thought were BioShock's additions to the genre than what it is. So essentially, you play a hacker, a very 90s styled hacker, and you are brought to this space station called Citadel Station by a guy that works for the Trioptimum Corporation, which runs it. And he's like, I want you to hack the AI that runs this entire ship. And you're like, oh, okay, what are you going to do? So he pays you in a like a super military chip, and he's like, I'll put this in your head, and in 6 months you'll wake up and you'll have really cool powers, and I just need you to hack this AI. So you hack the AI and then go to sleep for 6 months, and then you wake up and it turns out that AI has absolutely fucking obliterated the station. It has taken over, and you basically need to reclaim the station and destroy the AI. And so that leads you go from deck to deck solving kind of various objectives and puzzles, many of which bear a striking resemblance to some of the things you might know from Bioshock. This is a story in which you have an antagonist that constantly taunts you as you go around the station. That's Shodan, this evil, malevolent AI that's turning everybody into cyborgs. Very
Does
much
it have
kind of
the notorious "look at you, hacker" line in it, or is that from System Shock 2?
So it's got the one where it's also got the one where she talks about God, that's a worthy title for me.
Nice.
A lot of the dialogue is taken directly from the script. For the most part, I think all of it is what they've tried to do is they've tried to make a very, very faithful remake while making it play like a modern game. But things that you'll see in it that you'll be reminded of Bioshock is the entire story is pretty much told through audio logs that are really haunting and horrible and actually are useful rather than just the modern sense of the audio log, which is here's some self-indulgent lore to listen to.
Here's someone's diary.
Yeah, no, the most pickups are colouring in the world, but an awful lot of them actually tell you what to do because there are no mission objectives, there are no waypoints, there's nothing like that. You have to work out what to do, and the audio logs are really the way that you learn it. So Vita chambers, which we all thought were the thing that was put in Bioshock because modern gamers were shit and couldn't deal with actually kind of hardcore combat. They're in this. You have replicators that bring you back to life when you die and keep the progress that you've done.
What is the core combat? Cause like you, I know System Shock, but I've never played, like never really properly looked at it. I think I played a bit of 2.
2 is my memory. Very good. Mm-hmm. Even now, I think it's still pretty good.
For one, what is like the combat? Is it melee or is it shooter?
So you have some melee weapons and you have ranged, and the fundamentals of Bioshock are very much there. Like the lead pipe, which is the first weapon you get, is massively important, certainly for as far as about the kind of like halfway point that I've got to. I've swapped it for a wrench. The wrench in this game is the throwback to the System Shock 2 wrench. It's the bright yellow one with the little beams on it.
And it's got like a little knobble hanging off of it, if I remember correctly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's important. It's got to have that.
But you do get weapons. This has got, I'd say System Shock is more survival horror than what Bioshock eventually becomes. So weapon conservation and ammunition and all of that, much more kind of a vital part of this. They've put the Resident Evil style inventory in it. So you've got like a grid and very much kind of rotating things and Tetrising it to keep everything in line is a huge part of it. But like Bioshock, every weapon has different ammunition that can be loaded into it. And the different ammunition is obviously important against different types of enemies. But because of the ammunition conservation elements to it, and there's much more of a haunted house vibe to Citadel Station because it's very maze-like, very labyrinth. So you're going into lots of small rooms of very cramped corridors. So the fights are obviously a setup to deal with that more confined space. So you're pretty much only ever fighting a couple of things at any one go. So it's not got the bigger combat encounters that Bioshock has. You're not fighting anything really like a big daddy. And you don't have kind of like a dozen splices coming after you. But you can see the origins of Bioshock's combat system in the way that its guns work.
Yeah. So do you think, after playing this, like, Bioshock is still one of the greatest games ever. Has it made you think of it in any different way? Not necessarily in a less light, like, not saying, thinking this is more derivative.
Yeah, it might not be as influential as we thought
it was.
Has it
made you think, like, oh, they maybe it isn't as, I don't know, lightning in a bottle as it felt?
Not in a derogatory way. I think for me, as someone that had always struggled to play System Shock because of the original design, it's really cool to have an accessible version of System Shock where I'm like, oh, wow, like the things that I like about Bioshock are, it's obviously not as narratively focused. Bioshock is much more of has a heavier narrative thrust, and every area of Bioshock is designed to tell this massive story. And there's a little bit less of that in System Shock because it doesn't really have there's not an Atlas style character that's guiding you through the game. It's much more self-directed than that. But I got to a point where you have to rewire a door, and it's like, oh, it literally is the pipes puzzle from Bioshock. It's just that I'm using a rerouter for wires rather than pumping fluid, basically through it.
You know, hacking fluid.
Yeah.
do we like think?
My point here is that it's I get another BioShock game is what I do.
Yeah.
Is it, because it's so similar, it doesn't mean that BioShock feels like a ripoff of what the original System Shock is. Because Ken Levine made System Shock 2. He obviously made the sequel to this and then went off and made his own version of a shock game. There will be a piece in a couple of days on the site, which is me essentially saying all of what I've just been saying. But I think it's an essential history lesson for anybody that loves BioShock. I think you can go back and, yes, it's not as... Even in its remake format, it's for a more hardcore player. It's got nothing that's going to guide you through it. You have to work it out yourself. Whereas, obviously, BioShock has a giant arrow that hangs in the sky over you to tell you where to go. So it's much more hardcore in that old 90s PC sense. But a lot of what I love about BioShock is here. And it's great to experience that sort of thing, but in this very lurid cyberpunk style environment.
Well, it may even be the fact that the team remaking this were kind of inspired by BioShock as well to make it even slightly more. I don't know if that's unfair to they may have even looked at BioShock and been like, well, we can just kind of make it a bit more like that than it ever was.
Certainly in terms of so when I say that there's the rewiring puzzles, the way that they were portrayed in the original System Shock is that in the bottom right corner, you'd have essentially a grid where you just like clicked on it and it mm-hmm. filled it with certain things. Now, when you do it, you go up to a panel on the wall. It's very diegetic. And when you click on it, the panel folds open and it slides towards you. And in it, you can see all of these conduits and the way that you click around and move things. So in that, the visual presentation of it is much closer to what BioShock's visual presentation of that same idea is. So there is a certain amount of to update it and bring it forward. You're also looking at the spiritual successor as much as you're looking at the origin point of all of this. So there is that. But, you know, I've been playing the enhanced edition alongside the remake just to see when you know the layout of a room in the remake, it's much easier to then be able to navigate it in the old one, even though it's very, very archaic.
Yeah.
And it is surprising to see things like, oh, was this added in for the remake just to make it feel more modern? And you're like, oh no, it is in the original version. I just alarmed basically at how ahead of its time the original one was. And by putting a modern interface and modern graphics onto those same ideas, it suddenly makes it feel like it is a thing of not necessarily 2023, but certainly a lot more modern than a 1994 game that's barely playable.
Yeah, sounds great. I mean, if I ever find time, I want to check it out. Mm-hmm. If you're patiently waiting for a new BioShock or Judas, maybe check out System Shock. Which it's out now, is it?
It is out now on PC. Mm-hmm. It will be out on console, from what I understand, a little bit later. I don't think there's any date on it. And of course, if all of this does sound a little bit too 90s, my other recommendation, as ever, is Prey, which is the best successor to System Shock.
And sadly might be the last ever Arkane Austin game.
Recording that.
I know. Arkane will keep going.
Arkane will survive.
Yes. I don't want to make that prediction because I'd hate it if it comes true.
No. Well, neither do I, but I said it. There we go. Let's get on.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Listen closely. As a master painter carefully brushes Benjamin Moore Regal Select down the seam of the wall. It's like poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
To some of your feedback. IGN_UK feedback@IGN.com. A reminder, we will be having a little spoiler succession section after these feedback emails, so stick around if you want to hear us talk about that lovely little family in New York. First though,
none of them ever did anything wrong.
Exactly. Lovely people. What's the first email
we've got? A comment here from Jake Howry saying, Cardi mentioning he's never made it through Skyrim reminded me of my greatest gaming shame. I've never made it more than an hour past the prologue of Red Dead Redemption 2. I bought this game new, and in theory, they put in so many systems I've always wanted in an RPG, yet I can't get past the awkward control scheme that leads me to try and say hi to someone and then accidentally shoot them in the face. It's sitting on my PS5 right now, taunting me to go back and play for another try. Any tips to help me clear this hurdle and finally move it off my backlog? Respect the sea, Jake from DC. I'm choosing to believe that's the DC universe. Watch out for the Joker.
I'd say just get on with it, Jake's the best game ever made. Just do it.
I think the first time that I ever played Grand Theft Auto 4 was around a mate's house, and it's the same button. He accidentally pressed it and dropped a grenade out of a car by accident, blowing himself up. And we were like...
That's not ideal.
Yeah. We were like, just imagine in real life, like, breaking a car window open and dropping a grenade and blowing yourself up and killing yourself by accident.
It can happen. Games break your brain, though, don't they? I have been playing so much Zelda, and Ascend is such a ridiculously good ability that, like, I have been playing Cyberpunk and been like, oh, I wish I could just ascend to the top of the
place. I thought you were saying in real life it'd be easier if you're like, oh, I need to get something from the attic.
It'd be amazing. Tips, however, I don't know. I never found it. It's not, don't get me wrong, not the most intuitive control scheme. Can sometimes be a little bit fiddly because there are different options for some buttons, but I don't know.
I think Red Dead actually probably has the issue that, maybe not to the same extent as Zelda does, in the... it's a game that allows you to do so many things that it has way more options for you to do than it literally has buttons on the controller. So it has to then seed things in weird places. Zelda is very much, it seeds them in weird menus, particularly when you're trying to do the fuses. Yeah. And I think Red Dead, because it needs to contextually add so many things to so many buttons, and... I'm guessing, is shoot on the same button as interact with a person?
No, I think one's R2 and one's I can't remember. It's been a couple of years since I played Red Dead. Mm-hmm. But, it's because you have to aim at the person with L2. And if you could accidentally shoot instead of pressing, like, greet.
Right.
similar things.
You have to lock onto the people. But I would say get through that prologue, because the prologue I like, but that game doesn't really get going until you do the first little... like a robbery mission and then get and actually make camp near Valentine. That's where the game really hits its flow, is when you, like, 2 hours in, I'd say, when you get to Valentine, and that's
So essentially, I don't think Jake has any problem with the narrative. It just seems like the system and particularly the control scheme. So I guess what you're saying is persevere.
I'm going to say it's persevere. And maybe once you maybe unlock that the key parts of the game and where it becomes really excellent there is like you almost kind of put any worries about controls to the back of your mind just to experience it. But I would never knock it for its controls.
I think and this is advice that is as good for Red Dead and Tears of the Kingdom and real life, is to just find joy in your failures. Like, just, that's a really funny story that you accidentally shot someone when you wanted to say hi. Like, play the game as if more of that stuff might happen.
Everyone in that world is there to be messed with in Red Dead. It's a very funny, it is one of the funniest games ever made without ever... Well, sometimes it's scripted to be funny, but like you can make Arthur the funniest man on earth if you really want to. I love that game so much. Other Matt,
this one,
new email, please.
This one is from Sophia in Sweden, who says, "Hello, IGN UK team, long time, second time, love the show, etc." The trailer for the new Transformers movie, Transformers: Rise of the Beasts, appeared in my social media flow recently. I watched it and thought it looked really cool and interesting. This got me thinking about live-action Transformers movies of the past. The first few movies came out when I was young enough to find most movies interesting. I remember my little brother being obsessed with watching the movies again and again at home, which meant that I was forced to watch them again and again as well. And when he was old enough, our mom even brought him to the cinema to watch Age of Extinction when it came out. By this time, I had watched a bunch more movies and built a sense of what a good movie was, and suddenly the Transformers franchise was labelled as bad movies in my mind. I think this shift also coincided with when the Marvel movies came out. Some of the Marvel movies were so funny and so well made that other movies paled in comparison in my teenage opinion. Or perhaps I had just become tired of my brother forcing me to watch the same movies over and over. Anyways, I'm thinking of going to see Transformers: Rise of the Beasts in the cinema. Partially because it looks cool and also for old time's sake. But I want your opinion. Are any of the Transformers movies any good? What do you think about Transformers: Rise of the Beast from what you've seen? Thanks for making a very entertaining podcast. Respect the sea, from Sophia.
I will say, when I was in Leicester Square yesterday for Spider-Verse, they already had some Transformers, some big ones there.
Oh, I think I've
Optimal
seen...
Prime and the big gorilla
you
one.
Met
I don't know. Yeah. Optimal Prime, I believe. So Optiprimal, I don't know. Optimus Primal.
Yeah.
Optimus Prime. I don't know any of the Beast stuff. I still think the first Transformers pretty good.
Yeah.
The first one's still
an
enjoyable
original animated movie.
Well, that one, also enjoyable. But no, like the first Michael Bay one. It's pretty good.
I think probably
I haven't seen it in a long time.
Yeah, I think from probably now we're all older and understand that certain shooting techniques of Michael Bay are maybe a little bit seedy. There is some unfortunate things for Megan Fox, but I think as like pure action adrenaline, I do remember enjoying the first one and thinking that there were some really smartly done big action sequences that felt very... Obviously not the same as Terminator 2, but it got that kind of T2 energy to it. Just a relentless, non-stop kind of crashy-bashy.
Yeah.
My memory is that things go significantly downhill from that point on, and I only watch the next two.
Yeah, I think I only watched Revenge of the Fallen, then Dark Side of the Moon. I definitely didn't see Age of Extinction. I didn't see the Wahlberg ones, basically.
No.
I was like, when... I was like, if Sam Witwicky's out, then I'm out. That's basically what I was thinking. I remember the third one, Dark. I wouldn't say Dark Side of Moon, it's just Dark of the Moon. Yeah.
That I just remember
pretty
being
bad.
That's about 3 hours long, isn't it? And I think it was just relentless. Yeah. Like, relentless and very difficult to track the action. I think that's the thing that the first one felt a bit more... The way that the camera moved with obviously an awful lot of CG, I felt like you could figure out, like you could see what was going on. And there were some very cool moments where you'd have like them transform in midair and then drop down onto things. Whereas the second one, I remember kind of having a lot of really well-tracked shots and then it started to get a little bit more confusing. And by the third one, I remember it just being like a whirl of metal and not really understanding how to follow the narrative along with the action.
I've just looked up that third one, Dark of the Moon, when it released, the fifth highest grossing film of all time.
Fucking hell. Jesus.
There we go. It deserves it.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't say I have a lot of love for the Transformers films, but I do remember enjoying that first one.
I think the first one's got slightly less of the annoyances. Like, I think I can remember audibly groaning in the cinema when in the second one's where they go to like Egypt, is it? And
yeah,
they have
the pyramids. Yeah,
they have like a robot that's got balls, like they're made out of wrecking balls, and they hang between its legs.
I mean, that sounds incredible.
I used to watch the Beast Wars animated show, and I remember really enjoying it as a kid. Mm-hmm. So this one has oddly captured my attention just because
nostalgia.
But it has made me wonder whether or not I should go back and revisit that, if it was actually any good at the time.
Well, yeah. There we go. Transformers. Yeah.
Beast Wars is from the CG era.
Yeah,
of
exactly. So it looks wonky. If you've
I was
going to
say,
me.
Like, does it just look like Reboot? Can you remember Reboot?
I do remember Reboot. It was. I think it might have been just after Reboot, mm-hmm. if I remember right. So maybe they figured some stuff out. But I loved. I remember being a kid and thinking it was cool that an animal was a robot. Mm-hmm. Like, that is cool.
Yeah, I've seen the Rise of the Beast trailers and. Yeah, it's not doing a lot for me, I won't lie to you.
Yeah, I've not watched it. Is Anthony Ramos, is he the lead in this
one? Yeah, he's now, yeah.
It just seems bizarre to me that there's so little continuity between... It feels like there's no continuity between any of the Transformers films and what their cast is.
I mean, this one isn't Bay as well, is it? It's Stephen Caple Jr. did Creed 2, surely, if he's directing it.
What I will say is there is one Transformers film that I can genuinely absolutely say is still good and I would recommend it, which is Bumblebee.
It's all right, actually.
It's Travis Knight, isn't it, who's one of Leica's directors who did it. And Hayley Steinfeld is good, and it felt a
John
lot
Cena
more...
gives a pretty good performance.
Yeah, it felt like a good, heartfelt Transformers film rather than purely dedicated to the smashy crashy.
Yeah, there we go.
God, I forget so that I really films. Liked that, actually, Bumblebee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was just good, like, really good.
Lovely. Good stuff. Good. I wasn't expecting a Transformers chat today, but here we are. I've got an email from Tom Meller. He says, "All right, gang. I've been with my girlfriend for just over 2 years. In that time, I've been trying to get her around to the idea of playing some games, and she's shown a genuine interest in getting involved with one of my passions. The Last of Us was the first game I suggest we play together. It's my favourite game of all time, and I genuinely thought she'd love the story because she's a sucker for anything vaguely dystopian. Problem came when I suggested she watch me play it. I appreciate this wasn't the idea she might have had in mind when I suggested we play together, but knowing her as a person who doesn't like being bad at things, even on the easiest difficulty, I knew she'd play, get frustrated, and very quickly give up, missing out on the incredible narrative of the game. Anyway, she was having none of it, and the idea quickly died. I mean, to be fair, I'd think watching anyone play a game. I know people do it literally for hours on Twitch, but I don't understand watching someone else play a game. Personally, but there we go. This was until The Quarry came onto PS Plus Extra. It was perfect. Very simple mechanics, juicy bit of horror, the fact we could influence who lived and died. She loved it and played through most of it herself. We've gone back to work through Until Dawn, and whilst it's a little different, we'll be doing Detroit Become Human next. A game that actually me and Matt have a little bit of a soft spot for, despite obviously having some issues. Yeah. but there we go. Problem is, I don't really know where to go after that. We could do the Dark Pictures anthology, but I've heard it's rubbish. I think it's a mixed bag. They're just not on the level of Until Dawn, and neither was The Quarry, if you ask me, but there we go. Then there's the Walking Dead games, but I think I want to start progressing her up through the ranks of complexity. I just can't think of what would be next level before you get to a God of War. But that is a big step from The Quarry to God of War. My question is, can you think of any games that are more complex than an Until Dawn, but less complex than a God of War, that are cinematic, have at least a half-decent story, and ideally there's a bit of death in there? There we go. We're looking for the stepping stone for anyone that's new to games, basically, from like a choice-based Telltale game.
I think the answer's there. It's The Walking Dead, because The Walking Dead increases in complexity as it goes on. The final season of The Walking Dead is played from a third person Resident Evil style perspective, and there's a little bit of easy combat in there. So if that's the sort of thing, I would use that as the next step, play through all of that to get your partner to that level, and then maybe think of what the next...
Even to the end of the first season, it starts ramping up in complexity because there's that like quite time sensitive triggers for some of the end of it, which I think, like, even if you played that first season and then were like, oh, this is cool, which you won't, because the second season's pretty good too.
Those are very solid choices. I'd always suggest someone that's relatively new to games check out What Remains of Edith Finch, just because that is a game where you're mostly walking around, and then there's, you know, some of the memories have some gameplay mechanics to them, but also, they ease you in, and it's just a phenomenal story, and it does have quite a bit of death. If you want
that. From a newbie's perspective as well, is that Edith Finch is first person, right? And as people that have played games for 30 years or whatever, it's easy to think that first person is easy, but for people that have never played games before, the kind of controlling the two axes at the same time on... A gamepad is a fundamentally weird thing for people that haven't grown up on them. I think Edith Finch is probably a good shout there.
And I know you're a big Life is Strange fan as well, Matt.
I think that's not, that won't ramp up in any sort of difficulty at all, but I do like those stories,
This is the answer that I give to all of these questions, but it slots in so well. The answer, the game that you're looking for is Yakuza Like a Dragon, which is got movement, but, you know, it's in a 3D perspective. It has got, like, action and death and actually a really functionally good story. And all of the combat's turn-based, too.
Yeah. So turn-based is always a good step. If you really want to jump in with Persona 5...
I did think about, like, either, like, the Phoenix Wright games, but they're maybe a little bit less cinematic. Or Danganronpa, which has a pretty cool murder mystery story. But yeah, maybe it's not the amount of complexity. And it's a little bit weird.
You're taking a leap there with that one. But
I'm trying to think of some horror games that have got that are a little less that are intense, but intense from a cinematic perspective.
Maybe Layers of Fear, something like that.
The Bloober games, I think, are less kind of focused on the actual running away from shit, right?
Stanley Parable.
Horrible from a different perspective of purely just horrible jump scares. But most horror games do tend to require that you actually have, like, a high level of dexterity to actually do the escape. But I'm sure, like, would Amnesia be... I think there's bits where Amnesia gets a bit games. Too demanding.
Bit too wet.
I would say
and a bit... I was going to say Alien Isolation, but that's actually, that's quite gameplay heavy. Hopefully that helps. If it didn't, I'm very sorry. But there you go.
I like Yakuza, but I don't like it enough. I recommend it every time, and yet it's like, I think it's fine.
IGN underscore UK feedback at IGN.com. If you want to write in anything, I won't be on the next couple episodes, so, you know. Don't ask me anything. Ask these guys whatever you want. Get as weird as you want while I'm gone. I don't care.
I think we'll talk about The Flash next week.
I've
seen it. Not going to tell you anything.
There we go. Tease. What a tease. Mm-hmm. What we can talk about now, though, is Succession. This is your warning. If you haven't watched Succession, turn off now, because I'll probably put in, I don't know, a soundbite of one of...
Put the theme tune on. I'll put Elton the OG in between.
I'll put on something Succession-based. Thank you for listening if you're not into Succession. If you're into Succession, we'll be back in a second. Woo-hoo! Oh, it's a good television show.
I cannot believe that they stuck the landing.
I had full faith, that's the thing, but still, when they did it, I was like, yes.
Do you know why I think this finale is what it is as good as it is? It's because it's the finale that, I don't know if you agree, but it's the finale I saw coming from the moment the game from it started, and they didn't divert and try and do something clever or sneakier. The ending that this show needed, which was everybody fucking lost.
Yeah, I wish I'd told someone, because, like, I was convinced it was going to be Tom, and, like, I don't want to be like, I knew it all along, but, like, a few episodes ago is where I really started clocking it, and I was like, this is what's happening.
I didn't necessarily start out this season thinking that Tom was going to become the CEO. No. I just knew, and I knew from the way that this show started back in season one, that none of these people could succeed, because even though I think Succession does a good job of... It's a show that doesn't really show its hand in what the show's actual politics are. It likes to keep a bit of distance so it can allow Shiv to be this weird sort of like she's Democrat but not, and allows Roman to be a weird Nazi boy and stuff like that. But
her,
it never,
like, being a Democrat is kind of influenced by the fact that she is a billionaire as well. Like, yeah. It's purely performative when it comes down to it.
But the show very rarely plays its hand right. But there's always a sense that, like, the show is critical, and so therefore the show comes from our styles of perspective. So it's like, it's never going to let any of these people get their own way, because the show fundamentally understands that these are all horrible people. And so I think I've always known and always had faith that the show would deliver an ending that meant Shiv, Roman, or Kendall were never going to get what they wanted. It was probably only at the start of the final episode that I was like, oh, if Shiv isn't getting what she wants, that means that it feels like it's going to be Tom. But I do love the Lady Macbeth final shot for her.
It's
very good.
The I started clocking it. Yeah, once it was, they started discussing the US CEO, and I was like, it doesn't mean it's you.
Yeah,
that's like that was very.
Like, but again, it makes sense, right? Like, Tom is so easy to manipulate. Like, he has been the person that will mold himself to whatever someone that can get him where he wants to be.
It's what Shiv says just before he gets it, is like, he will suck the biggest dick in the room, which is what he will do. And I love
that the scene where he's interviewing for the position of the CEO, all he thinks he's doing is just trying to keep his existing job. He doesn't even think that he's in the road for it, and yet he gets it. I clocked it too during the funeral, and a lot of people have said this too. I don't want to seem like I'm a genius, but which I am, of course, but I'm modest too. It's exactly like the first episode where Kendall goes to Logan's birthday party, but Logan is disappointed by that because he's not putting the merger first. But Tom doesn't go to the funeral because he's working, which is him putting work first, which means that he's the guy that should actually be in the position.
Yeah. I just don't know who they're giving awards to for this show, because this is going to sweep the acting awards, I think. And I just don't know who, like, out of Kendall and, like, for most of the season, I was like, oh, this is Kieran Culkin as Roman. He's been unbelievable. That last episode, Kendall was just off this, like, Jeremy Strong is.
Yeah.
I know he's deeply method actor, and I don't actually, from all the interviews, he seems perfectly fine to me, but people seem to like to have a go. But, like,
in that same episode, phenomenal. We get him about to throw himself into a river, and also meal fit for a king.
It's so good. Like, it is just so Godfather at the end as well, and that's what I love. Like, it is just, like, yeah. They've watched The Godfather Part 2, is what I'm saying. Like, and if you haven't, do yourself a favour and watch The Godfather Part 2.
The stuff with Kendall, the thing I love about so much about that finale is that not everything comes back to this, but a significant part of that final story arc is it brings it back to the idea that Kendall's a child. Like, he is so child. And I love it that they start to set that up with where they're at the swimming pool, and he's like, he promised me when I was 7 years old that I'd get it. And then when they're actually having their fucking wonderful fight in the boardroom, and they're smacking each other about, he's just like, I'm the eldest boy.
And then Shiv's just like, no, you're not.
You're not even the eldest boy.
Because everyone forgets about Connor, because Connor's so forgettable. But that bringing it, like Kendall was never going to get it because he's just a kid. Like, he's never grown up. He's so immature. And, you know, where it all builds on goes all the way back to season one with all of the mistakes he made with the waiter, the fact that he's a killer. And I love how, like a child, he's just completely like, no, I didn't do that. It wasn't me. You know, you've got it wrong. Nothing about this.
I love that he has an excuse already prepared in his head.
Yeah.
Like, he's decided to think that. He believes it by that point, which, man.
Like, in the end, kind of Roman is the smartest one, because he's the one who realizes it shouldn't be us. Yeah. We're idiots. Mm-hmm. Like, and you kind of see the relief on his face at the end when he's drinking Jerry's drink as well, which is a very smart. Every detail is so good this show. But, like, yeah, you can see, like, he's kind of relieved, I think. Like, he didn't really ever want it. I don't think he just felt like he needed to want it. Like, I don't know.
The great thing about, obviously, even though Logan wasn't in much of this show, like, it's the specter of Logan that hangs over all of this, right? And kind of like you say, that he knew that he was never going to get it just because of the way that he recognizes that their dad toyed with them and sort of pulled them to this place. And I think that sense of Roman that's had for like the last two seasons of this desperation, like, no, I'm the actual kid that gets on with dad, like I'm the one he sees. But ultimately, that kind of sense of being the good kid to the proud father was always the thing that was like layering over. He knew that none of this was going to work.
Yeah, I just loved there was a show full of just ridiculous things happening all the time, but never reached that point of implausibility to me where I was like, well, that would never happen. Like, the thing that everyone was like, a lot of people were convinced, like, it's going to be Greg. It's like, no, it isn't. It makes absolutely zero sense. It makes because everyone's like, Game of Thrones kind of did that, but like, Game of Thrones didn't really do that either. Yeah. Like, but like,
Game of Thrones fell into doing it. They didn't decide that was the thing that they wanted.
Like, it would have made that would have been like, if it had ended with Greg, like, Mattson choosing Greg, it'd been like, well, that makes zero sense. He thinks
everybody
he's an idiot.
Everybody doesn't like Greg. There's only and Tom he's an that idiot. Likes Greg.
Exactly. Like, it's just
the
it's
best just, like, scene. Of the episode as well is the dinner party that they're watching on a video because they get to see Logan in a way that we as viewers have never seen him. Like, diegetically in the show, he's never shown them any of the, like, half the kindness of the people in that room.
And it's interesting that Connor's at that dinner as well, right? Like, he's the only son that was invited to that.
But he's never in a position to actually be, like, useful or to be leveraged against for Logan, right? Like, but the other three can actually be manipulated. Oh, it's great. It's really good. Yeah. And also, like, Connor, he has that line in a previous episode about how, like, Logan never liked him.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's why Logan can actually let him get close, because he does like him. Or doesn't, sorry. Yeah. Good.
Connor and Willa. What a sad story.
I love that, like, maybe the fascist isn't even going to get elected anyway as well. Which means that the kids have had no impact on the world at all.
That line where like, is it Rome that's like, oh, so the deal, you know, we're cool, right? And it's just like, oh, maybe, we'll see, depends on kind of how things... And it's like that classic fucking right-wing politician thing of, like, you run on all of... I mean, obviously, a lot of politicians on all wings do this, but all the promises that you do in the pre-election, and then it's like, oh, probably not going to live up to anything that I told
you. That'll actually happen, I just love when, like, Connor and Will are already looking... Like, she was basically looking forward to being, like, away for 3 months. It's like, oh, the three-day itch.
Willa is the winner in this. She gets Logan's house, she gets to put all of her cool furniture in it, and her husband fucks off for like 6 months.
I love Willa.
Unless he doesn't, which is like it fails for her, but it's good for society generally.
I'm gonna miss this show, but I'm just so glad it ended perfectly. It's as good a finale, like, outside of The Sopranos for me. Like, I'd put it up against any, like, show ending episode, I think. And I just did a spare at the moment, like, TV rankings thing last night of my top 10 shows. I was like, I slid it in at 4. I was like, I feel good with that. Like, at times this was the best thing I've ever watched, but
I do think so.
Like,
fans so at home good. Might recognize that Barry also ended on the same evening, and I don't feel as compelled to talk about that one. Just kind of ended.
So you
know, we won't spoil Barry.
Thing. But what I will say is, like, I was compelled by the first couple of episodes of Barry this season, but it didn't go in the direction I wanted it to. And ultimately, you know, the creators can do whatever they want, and absolutely, I'd always stand up for creators doing what they want. But for me, Barry is a 3-season show.
I think this
like
season
Dexter's
I still
a
really
5-season show.
Right, yeah. I really enjoyed this season of Barry, but it's not on the same level.
Yeah.
Anyway, TV, like, that's all the good TV. Like, what are we watching now?
Well, nothing, because the writer's strike.
That's like, true. Maybe is everyone looking forward to The Idol starting on Sunday? That looks like an absolute
mess. Is this the one from the Euphoria guy?
Yeah. I like Euphoria, but from everything
like
I've read,
an absolute disaster in the making. This does not sound
I have some morbid curiosity. But yeah, it sounds quite distasteful. But who knows?
Maybe a curious watch still counts the same. So
exactly. Succession will miss you. What's he going to do next? More Peep Show? Bring Peep Show back? Can't wait. Can't wait. There's not more. I just told myself it's going to be more Succession. There's not. It's all done.
You're planning a rewatch?
Do you know what? I've only watched the last episode once. I need to watch it again. It's essentially a film, so I'm just going to stick it on at some point this weekend, I think. But yeah, Succession. We'll miss you.
Now play L to the OG.
Okay, now we'll play L to the OG. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
See ya.
L to the OG. Dude be the OG. A-N, he playing. Playing like a pro. See, L to the OG. Dude be the OG. A-N, he playing. Playing like a pro. A1 ratings, 80k wine. Never gonna stop, baby, fuck father time. Bro, don't get it twisted, I've been through hell. But since I stand dad, I'm alive and well. Shaper of views, creator of news. Father of many, paid all his dues. So don't try to run your mouth at the king. Just pucker up, bitch, and go kiss the ring.
Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink. But there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration. I'll give myself a pat on the back for that. As well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please, join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.